1 Corinthians 11:1 to 11:16 was presented by Ron Julian on August 10, 2005 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Disenculturating the Gospel. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Here's the approach I'm going to take this morning, or I guess now this afternoon. There are many, many interpretive problems in 1 Corinthians 11. There are many, many, there are words that have to be interpreted, there's cultural background to sort out, there are relationships between ideas to sort out, and there's just a lot going on there. I was fortunate enough to discover something that I had forgotten, that I actually wrote a paper on this passage a couple years ago for a class I was taking, and I found it, and it helped remind me what I thought was going on in this passage. But the fact is that I only picked a handful of issues in this passage to talk about, and it was a 25-page paper. So I just can't, in half an hour, talk about all of the things that needed to be talked about here. What I'm doing this morning is concentrating on the main thing I want to talk about first is this question of how particularly in this passage are we going to make this decision about the cultural practices. That is, the specific thing that Paul says about women doing something with their heads, is that a transcultural practice? Is it something that he expects that ought to happen in every culture? Or is it particularly germane to the culture that he's speaking to? How would we make a decision like that? That's what I want to concentrate on, because that's related to our topic here today. So there are lots of questions to talk about. I don't know how many of the interpretive issues in the passage I will be able to address with you actually, but I want to start with that. You're going to encounter people who will argue on both sides on this question of whether head coverings, as it's described in 1 Corinthians 11, whether the issue is a cultural one or not. That is, you will find people that argue it is not obligatory for women in our culture to wear something on their heads when they pray or prophesy, because that was a culturally determined issue. Others, such as R.C. Sproul, in his family, the women in his family wear head coverings when they go to church. And his argument is, look, this isn't just cultural. Paul is appealing to the created order when he makes this argument. So it's not just cultural. He's saying this is the way God made things. So how are we going to assess that? I mean, R.C.'s point seems like a pretty strong one. Are we taking something that is intended to be of eternal significance and downplaying it as something cultural? Or has he misunderstood what the argument is in the passage? Well, I would like to argue that both things could be true, that Paul is appealing to eternal truths in the creation, and specifically the issue of whether you wear something on your head is a cultural one. And let me give an example here of what I'm talking about. Suppose, and this is somewhat artificial, I made this up and you'll see it's a little artificial, but suppose I know a group of married Christian men who have been going out on the town and picking up single women. They're married Christian men, but they like to kind of go out and flirt with the ladies and so on. So I might write to them, I want you married men to stop trying to pick up single women. God joined you and your wife as one flesh, and you must remain faithful to the exclusive covenant you have made with your wife. Okay, piece of cake. Now, my insistence that they stop dating single women is not culturally determined. The faithfulness required in marriage is transcultural. I hope that's clear. I mean, that's an eternal value. Now, as it happens, however, though, these Christian men are going out, and when they go out, they take off their wedding rings and they stick them in their pocket so that it is not apparent to the women that they're trying to pick up that they're married. So imagine now that I write to them, I want you married men to keep your wedding rings on. God joined you and your wife as one flesh, and you must remain faithful to the exclusive covenant you have made with your wife. Okay, could you say that because I appealed to the created order in that argument, that I was saying that wedding rings are a transcultural value, that in all cultures and all times you ought to wear a wedding ring? That wouldn't be a fair way of understanding what I'm arguing. My actual logic is the creation order requires faithfulness in marriage. Not wearing a wedding ring in our culture is a way of pretending that you're not married. Therefore, the creation order requires the men to keep their rings on in our culture and in this situation. So the eternal value is faithfulness in marriage. The cultural issue is that wedding rings in our culture communicate something. But in writing to them, I might leave out the middle step. I don't have to explain to them that wedding rings communicate something in our culture, because everybody knows that. That's why they're taking it off. They know that it communicates something. So I don't have to explain that to them. Well, Paul might very well be using the same kind of logic when he's writing to the Corinthians. The creation order tells us that man is the head of the woman, whatever that means, and so she should not disgrace him. Secondly, in our culture, a woman not wearing a head covering disgraces her husband. Therefore, the creation order requires her to keep her head covering on. So, there is an eternal truth that is being appealed to, but it is being applied in a particular cultural situation. So, I actually have a problem with R.C.'s argument with this passage. Yes, I agree with him, absolutely. There is something about the created order that is being appealed to, but it is being applied in a particular cultural situation. So, the fact that he's appealing to the created order doesn't necessarily tell us that the particular manifestation in that culture of how you would live that out applies to everyone. So, and in fact, I am inclined to think that when we put the whole thing together, that that is how we should understand it. That the eternal truth that he's appealing to is that God has created things so that the woman is the glory of the man, the man was created before the woman, and the woman was created on account of the man. This is the appeal that he makes to Genesis. He sees that as telling us something about the relationship between a husband and wife, I think. But how that particular truth that God has built into creation would be applied in a cultural setting would be different. So, that's the main point that I wanted to get across before we go into any more of the hairy details in this passage, is as we think about how would I go about deciding whether it's a cultural practice or not, it's not enough to just say, well, look, he's appealing to the created order. This is, in fact, what I should expect to see, and I'll talk more about this afternoon. The idea that the eternal truths of God are being applied in the Bible to a particular cultural situation. Sometimes the way it's being applied in that cultural situation would be the same as it would be applied in my cultural situation. There's no difference. Sometimes the way that eternal truth is applied in that cultural situation is different than the way it would be applied in mine, because the situation is different. And in this case, I would say right now, I don't think that it is incumbent on a woman to wear something on her head when she prays or prophesies or when she goes to church, because in that culture, head coverings communicated something, and that message was not a good message to communicate. But in our culture, they do not communicate the same thing, and so it is a matter of indifference. If, you know, when my wife prays, no one in our culture interprets her action as a disgrace to me because she doesn't have something on her head. So, since that's not being communicated, it's not a problem. That's how I would understand the issue as Paul's talking about it. That's what I wanted to get across this morning, is in terms of the cultural issue, I think that's how we ought to approach these questions. Now, I could be wrong. Perhaps in this case, there's something in Genesis that would imply specifically that, yes, women ought to have something on their heads. We would now have to argue that. You know, what exactly is his argument from Genesis, and what is it saying, and what is it not saying? But I wanted to say up front that that's the kind of approach that we should take. We shouldn't be surprised to see that sort of thing. Okay, so now, what does the creation order tell us? God through Christ is the head of the man, but man is the head of the woman. Man is the glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. Woman is made from man and not vice versa. Woman is made on account of man and not vice versa. What's the significance of that argument? Briefly, as I would understand it, and you understand, I don't have time to defend these things this morning. We don't have time to do a whole lot of things, actually. What we see in Genesis, Adam is created, given responsibility over the garden, and commanded not to eat the fruit from the tree. And then he is given a task to name all the animals. And in part, he is given that task, as we see, because God wants him to look at the animals, see what they are like, in naming them, assess what is their essential nature, and then discover at the end that although there are similarities in some ways between himself and the animals, that none of the animals are like him, that he is unique. And so at that point then, God introduces the idea it is not good for the man to be alone. He creates Eve to be a helper suitable to him. And now Adam says, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. At last, here is someone who is like me, which none of the other animals had been. I think this is the account that Paul is appealing to when he talks about the man was made first and the woman was made on account of, for the sake of the man. Because what it says is that it wasn't good for him to be alone and that God was going to make him a helper corresponding to him or suitable to him. Now, you may be aware that there are a lot of arguments that have been made about what the significance of that is on both sides. I am aware of those who come from a more feminist perspective who would argue that that phrase, helper suitable to him, that both of the words involved here are being misunderstood by those who understand that there's a concept of male headship. First of all, the idea of being suitable to him, they would argue, well, see, this is, it's like equal to him. And so the very phrase itself is indicating there is no difference in role between the men and the women. That it is being said specifically, she is the same as he is. She is equal to him. So there can't be, it has to be egalitarian. There can't be any difference. Well, my argument would be that no, it's, if we look at the context, it's pretty clear what this corresponding to him is talking about. Yes, there is an equality that's being talked about, but it is the equality of essence. It's the fact that whereas none of the animals are like him, it corresponds to him. She is one who is bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. So it's not addressing the issue of roles, it's addressing the issue of personal being. This is a human being just as he is a human being. So I think that's a better way to understand what corresponding to him is talking about. And then the other argument that is made, which is a good argument as far as it goes, but I think it ends up with the wrong conclusion, is we talk about the word helper. The argument is made that this word isn't used that often, and when it is used in the other places it's used, it is God who is described as the helper of Israel. So, does helper indicate some sort of subordination? Obviously, God is not subordinate to Israel, so her being a helper doesn't indicate that she has any sort of subordinate, necessarily, role as far as the man is concerned. Well, I think that's up to a point. That's an important thing to notice, but I think we have to take it farther. I've been helped in my own thinking about this in an analogy that Jack has made regarding this issue that I think is very helpful and helps us to sort out how to think about this stuff. He talked about how, when his kids were younger, they would have math homework and he would help them with their math homework. On the one hand, he was the helper because he was better at math than they were. That's why he was helping them. But in another sense, it was not his math homework, it was their math homework. They were the ones who were responsible to do it. If they got an answer wrong, the kids couldn't say, my dad said that, because the issue is, what are you doing on your homework? So, to a certain extent, it's appropriate to recognize that God in his superiority is the helper of Israel. But it doesn't change the fact that, for instance, if God is to help Israel arrive at righteousness, it doesn't change the fact that it is their responsibility to be righteous. I mean, it is their lives that need help. God is better than they are and is coming along and helping them, but it's still their responsibility, not his. If we think about it in terms of the issue of responsibility, then we can see how the notion of helper does imply that the person who's helping obviously in some ways is superior to the person being helped, because otherwise they couldn't be any help. You know, if I'm going to ask you to help me with my math homework and you're worse at math than I am, you know, then we're in trouble because we're really not going to get very far. So I think that implicit in the idea of the woman being a helper to the man implies that she has to be superior in some ways to the man. She has to be better at something than he is. That's why she is suitable to be a helper. So I agree with the feminist perspective that helper does not imply inferiority. But I disagree with it that it necessarily implies that one of them couldn't have a prior responsibility and thus have the responsibility for something that the other person doesn't. Because I think that right now I want to say about this that I am not, I don't think, dogmatic about any of these issues, because 1 Corinthians 11 is a very difficult passage, and I recognize that there are a lot of hard decisions that have to be made. But right now, here is how I understand the notion of headship as it is explored in the Bible, and the notion of responsibility, authority, leadership in general. The basic idea, as I see it, is that responsibility implies authority. When I am responsible for something, if I have to give an answer for how something is going to go, then it is appropriate for me to have authority. It's not right that I'm going to take the rap for how it goes, but I have no say over how it goes. That would be wrong. There's something that's not right about that. So each of us, husband and wife alike, are answerable to God for our individual choices in life. So there are vast areas of my wife's life where I have no authority because she is the one responsible before God. I can't say to her, you ought to believe this, because in the end, she's the one who's going to answer to God for what she believes, not me. So if there is a concept of headship, it doesn't mean I get to tell her what to think or what to do or how to behave in many ways, because she is responsible before God for her life in that way, and so it is appropriate for her to resist me and say, no, I'm going to believe this, because in the end, I'm the one who's responsible. But in the joint enterprise of marriage, there are these two lives that are coming together as one, and there are aspects of that relationship where the two and the family unit that is a part of that are going to have to make some sort of choice about the direction that they're going to go. My understanding is that the responsibility for that joint venture lies with the husband. In the end, he's going to answer for the direction that the family went. Therefore, it is loving for the wife to recognize that since he's going to take the rap for it, he has the authority regarding it. But this has been greatly misunderstood and perverted in the church, I think, because we have equated the idea of authority with, I get to do what I want, I get my way, I get to tell you what to do, you know, that sort of thing. I think a better model, and I just wanted to say this is off 1 Corinthians 11 for a second, but I think if we're going to talk about this notion of headship, I think a better model is if you think about how a well-run business would work, that you have a manager who is responsible that a certain task be accomplished in the company, but a good manager is one who delegates to the ones who are best at doing things those things that they're good at doing. And that includes, at times, I think, a manager saying, I'm going to leave the decision about how to do this to you because I think you are better qualified to make this decision than I am. But what's true is the manager is saying, I will take the rap for it. It is my responsibility ultimately where we go, so I'm going to take your advice, but I will answer for it in the end. It seems to me that that's a better model of how the notion of responsibility in marriage works. I know that there are Christians who would look at my life and would say that their understanding of what headship means is that I ought to be telling my wife what to do. And I am therefore not being the head in my family because I'm letting her make decisions and, you know, this is terrible. Well, that's not my understanding of what's at stake. The fact is that my wife is better than I am at a lot of things. And if she is my helper, it would be foolish for me to step in and stomp all over it and say, no, we're going to do it my way. I mean, all that's saying is I don't need a helper. I can do this myself, which is arrogant and presumptuous. So all I'm trying to understand as the one who is responsible in my family is that I am willing to stand before God and say, yeah, I thought that our family should go the way she was saying. And in the end, I will be answerable for the certain communal aspect of that, whereas she will be answerable individually for what she did, and I will be answerable individually for what I did in my life. Okay, so I understand Paul in appealing to Genesis then to be appealing to the significance of the order in which they were created is that a certain responsibility was given to Adam and Eve was given to him as a helper, which is a great position of dignity, but it does indicate that there is a prior responsibility that he has. And that's the significance of the order, because the responsibility is prior with him. Now, there's a great, great amount of debate about the meaning of the word head. In what does it mean that the man is the head of the woman? I think that actually, in a way, that debate is somewhat misdirected, because once we understand the argument from Genesis, if head means have authority over, then it means have authority over in the sense that we see in Genesis, the prior responsibility that Adam has. If head means source, well, we can see that Adam was first. She was made from him. But in Genesis, what's the significance of that? He's the one who has the prior responsibility. So it comes back to that. So however we understand the word head, in the end it comes back to the idea that we see in Genesis of his prior responsibility. Now, how are we to understand the situation here? If we take that the eternal principle is that there is an appropriate prior responsibility that the man has, and that somehow it is appropriate for the woman to recognize that, to acknowledge that, to not fight against that, what does this have to do with the head coverings and the stuff that he's talking about there? Well, this is a complicated question. Partly, we would like to know what is the cultural practice at the time regarding head coverings. Some argue that head coverings are not an issue, but rather whether a woman has her hair up or down. That's something that has to be sorted out. There are three different cultures in view here, because Paul is a Jew writing to a church where some of the people are Jewish. He's writing to a Greek town in Corinth that is populated to a large extent by Romans. So is it Jewish culture, Greek culture, or Roman culture that we're talking about when it comes to head coverings? And in all three of those cases, we do not have definitive answers. There are differences of opinion about what Jewish women did at the time, what Roman women did at the time, and what Greek women did at the time. So it is very difficult to come to definitive cultural background information on this stuff. It is very difficult. It seems to me ultimately what we're going to have to do is say, in the end, if I can find a way of proposing a cultural background that makes sense out of what Paul's saying, that that's the best we're going to be able to do. Now, there are various proposals for what might be happening here. I think that there are certain weaknesses in all those proposals, so I'm not dogmatic about this, definitely. But I have to say that I like the proposal that Jack made a number of years ago. It makes sense to me, and it's the one that is in the front running for me right now, for being, you know, what it is that the situation is here. And Jack's proposal arose, I believe, from two observations. One of them was the first time he went to Africa, where many of the African men wear colorful headgear. You know, they have hats that they wear, and when they came into church, though, they took them off as a sign of respect to God. And we've seen that in our own culture. It used to be that men wore hats, but when you go into someone's house or if you go into church, it would be disrespectful to wear your hat into church. So one possibility is that the question is, culturally speaking, when I pray to God, what is the appropriate way for me to show my submission and respect? And for men, the appropriate thing to do would be, if they were wearing a head covering out on the street when they went to pray, they would take it off. Okay, this is part of the proposal that Jack is making. So for the men, I show my deference, I show my respect before God by taking something off my head. But in the woman's situation, it's more complicated. What is a woman going to do if the man is showing his respect to God by removing what's on his head? Is the woman going to keep something on her head? Because it's like she's, unlike the man, she's showing disrespect to God by keeping something on her head. Well, if that's the situation, what Paul is saying is, look, for the women, they have another consideration. Because in this culture, yes, to remove something from your head shows your respect to God, but for a woman to remove her head covering shows her disrespect to her husband. It's interpreted as the mark of a loose woman, a woman who is not affiliated with a husband. So it's her way. People are going to look at that and see her as showing her independence from her husband in doing that. And what Paul is saying is, well, when we appeal to the creation order, when we look at things, human beings, male and female alike, are made in the image of God and are the glory of God. But since the woman was made to be the helper of the man, she also has a certain respect that needs to be shown to her husband on that front. So Paul's advice is, for the women, do not disgrace your head, that is, your husband, by removing your head covering. God can take care of himself. He will not be offended by the fact that you have something on your head. But the people around you will think that you're dissing your husband if you take your head covering off, so don't do it. Okay, now, is that absolutely and perfectly the answer as to what was going on? I don't know. I've heard a number of proposals, and that one makes more sense to me than any of the other proposals that I've heard, which is why it is my current hypothesis for what it is that's going on there. There are obviously a number of other interpretive issues in the passage. There is that place where it talks about how the woman is tricky. What in the world is that talking about? And we have the further problem that if you notice in your Bibles, that phrase, a symbol of authority on her head, a symbol of, is not in the text. There is nothing even close to anything that means a symbol of in the Greek text. And in fact, what makes it really tricky is that phrase, the Greek phrase, the word authority, and then it's followed by a preposition. That word authority with that preposition shows up a number of times in Paul's letters. And in the other places where it shows up, it means something like to have authority over. I mean, so instead of saying a symbol of authority on her head, a very straightforward way to take the language would be a woman ought to have authority over her head. She ought to have the right to do what she wants with her head, is a very natural way to take that Greek phrase. The only problem is, how does that fit in with what it is that Paul has been saying? Because if you... Now, some who argue from a feminist perspective hammer on that and say, look, Paul's saying she has the right to do what she wants with her head. Don't you be telling her whether to put something on her head or not. Okay, but the problem is he just got done telling her to put something on her head, so how do we put those things together? And notice, if you look at the structure of it, what Paul basically does is says, look, the man ought not to have something on his head because of X, Y, and Z, but the woman's situation is different. Therefore, a woman ought to have authority on her head. Well, up here he said the man shouldn't have something on her head, but her situation is different, so the logic seems to suggest that it ought to be the woman ought to have something on her head. He shouldn't, she should. Which is why people come along and try to put in something like a symbol of authority or something like that, because they're trying to explain how to connect those things. I have a proposal to make. This is my own proposal. I've never heard anybody else propose this, so it's quite likely wrong. But there is this tension in this verse, okay? And the tension is this. The structure of the argument makes almost demands that here this means something like she does wear something on her head. But the phrase authority over is so common, it's such it's a very ubiquitous phrase, it shows up all the time, that there's this tension that you want to read it that way. I mean, it just feels like it ought to read that way. So how do we reconcile those two things? And here's my proposal, which is a little strange, but I like it. When we see Paul talking about, when he uses the phrase authority over, that's actually a little misleading. Most of the time what he means by having authority over, it's having authority over myself, meaning I have the freedom regarding. A good way to translate this phrase when he uses it in other places is freedom regarding. Not so much authority over, but freedom regarding. And if you were to picture the situation the way Jack described it, as, you know, the men are taking off their headgear to show respect to God, but what is it that the woman is going to do? One way to understand his argument would be, he's saying the man ought to not have something on his head. He is under obligation to not have something on his head because he's the glory of God. He shouldn't be disgracing his head by culturally communicating that he's not showing respect to God. But because the woman is the glory of the man, she has freedom over her head. And the idea would be she is not obligated to remove her head covering because she has another situation that's there. She doesn't want to show disrespect to her husband. So the man, there is no reason why he should keep his head covering on. He would be showing cultural disrespect to God. But the woman has the freedom to leave it on, is basically my proposal for what it is he's saying. Is that right? I don't know. What I like about it is it fits the structure of the argument and it uses the phrase in the common way that Paul uses the phrase. And that's why I like it. But it is a tricky question. Okay, there are a number of other things we could talk about, but we don't have time to do it. So hopefully that gives you at least a little perspective on the way some of these questions could be approached. Again, I want to highlight the important thing is on the cultural question, there is an eternal truth being applied to a specific culture. It's the eternal truth we want to preserve. Headship, whatever it means, is implicit in the created order, but how we apply it culturally can change. And that's the thing I think that we want to take away. We'll talk about that more this afternoon. Okay, thanks. Let's go eat.